Heidegger's conception of Dasein being there, writes Giorgio Agamben in the open, is simply an animal that has learned to become bored, who has awakened from its captivation to its own captivation. This awakening of the living being to its own being captivated, this anxious and resolute opening to a not open, is the human. By captivation, we are to understand those forms of stimulus in the life world which pull upon us and determine us, and so which captivate. Being there, being human for Heidegger, then designates merely that animal which has learned to enter into a becoming idle. In the figure of idleness, whose Locus Classicus is the scene of a deserted country railway station where Heidegger finds himself stranded, threatened with a picture postcard pastoral, perhaps, the word idle derives from the Greek word eidolon, meaning small picture, Agamben finds the hallmark of what he calls the anthropological machine, a set of techniques that produce the hard-worn fiction of human exceptionalism. Agamben will end his reading of Heidegger on the animal by asking by what logic, which latencies, by what order of propositions we may render this machine inoperative or marginally less lethal. Eschewing positive knowledge of the human as a quality or a category, Agamben will embrace a purely negative mode of knowledge that asserts at every opportunity the central emptiness, the hiatus that within man separates man and animal. Nevertheless, there exists within Agamben's reading of Heidegger another possible way forward that would inquire not into positive knowledge of the human, but instead of the animal. In particular, for Agamben, a very famous tick. For coincidentally, while Heidegger was metaphorically cooling his heels at that lonely country station, just a few hundred miles away in a laboratory in Rostock, zoologist Baron Jakob von Uxkull had managed to keep a tick alive for 18 years without nourishment. In a condition of absolute isolation from its environment, as Agamben notes wryly, under precise conditions, this tick had effectively suspended its immediate relationship with its environment, without, however, ceasing to be an animal or becoming human. But by what order of metaphysics might we account for the condition of this tick? Was it profoundly bored? Or was it, as a Renaissance humanist might have framed the question, at leisure? Per otium. Idling, free of everyday tasks and distractions. For Agamben, the prospect of animal otium, an otium decoupled from the mechanisms of the anthropological machine, might constitute an opening to another order of propositions about life and its parceling out into bios and zoe than is to be found in Heidegger. There's something, then, in pastoral that persists and attracts, and that's otium. Agamben's desire to suspend the relays of what he calls the anthropological machine serves as the rubric for much of my current work, though I'm perhaps less afraid of machines than he is. I'm interested in how the shifting, uncertain relationship between bios and zoe, human and other forms of life or liveliness, alters our relationship to the past. Alters our relationship with those texts we name past, and how we ration out effects of the past, successive hits of reference to a this that once was but now isn't, in our own discourses. For the likes of sociologists such as Bruno Latour, the contiguous swelling that muddies categories of being manifests as a biblically charged knocking that comes from an as yet unknowable elsewhere, a knocking on a door, or from beneath the humanist table, or from inside the lid of a coffin. This knocking signals a generalized revolt of means. Nothing and no one, he writes, reprising Kant, is willing any longer to serve as a simple means to the exercise of any will taken as an ultimate end. The tiniest maggot, the smallest rodent, the scantest river, the farthest star, the most humble automatic machines, each demands to be taken also as an end, by the same right as the beggar Lazarus at the door of the selfish rich man. The crisis, he says, is in our house, in our understanding of the collective, in our modes of inducting non-humans, so that they come to bear or speak to human relations. Indeed, it's not really our house at all. Not answering the call, disavowing the knocking as noise, refusing access to a discourse of ends, will only render the world more lethal. Ecology's aspiration to write the world without reduction upends our notions of scale, offering a radical challenge to our senses of commutative justice. How then to make good? How to eat well? How to answer the door? How to decide what's sound, a possible subject, and what's just noise? How to be hospitable to an uninvited, possibly quite lethal guest. What was Pastoral again? Given the stakes, the question sounds kind of ridiculous. We know what Pastoral is. It's a genre, mode, activity, vehicle, or poetic device, sometimes idealizing, sometimes ironic, that treats high themes in low costume. And depending on when and where you are, Pastoral serves as a vehicle for exploring issues of patronage, poetic servitude, or for mounting institutional critique. Figured as a retreat and engagement, a retreat from engagement with the world, with a portrayal of an idealized version as the world. As Rob Watson puts it in his hazarding, ambitious, unified field theory of Renaissance nature, of Renaissance culture, sorry, back to nature. Pastoral is thus another cultural phenomenon explicable as a response, often simultaneously as an inscribed banner of protest and a blank flag of surrender to the burdensome knowledge of mediation. In other words, the knowledge that there will be no unmediated access to something we call nature, or which passes as natural. In his hands, the vogue for pastoral in the 16th century, which dominates the mechanisms by which contemporaries attempted to dream away their time, becomes a vision of a society backing into nature that everywhere was felt to be receding from them. Jonathan Sauday intuits a similar reading at the end of his examination of the rise of the machine in Renaissance culture, the engine in his Engines of the Imagination, finding in his in the vogue for pastoral an ambivalent reaction to the possibilities offered by technology. Today, pastoral in its persistence is essentially something we use to frighten eco-critics, who are offering up what they think are friendlier distributions of knowledge or more capacious modes of description than those previously on offer. Don't you think that you're more holistic than thy vocabulary of networks, ecologies, webs, or collectives is just a wee bit too holistic? Nostalgic? Romantic? Well, yeah. Pass. Who's knocking on your door and getting no answer? Come on. How do you really feel about slum? That is, about those forms of life that lack charisma, which are lethal, or who are so unphotogenic that it's not possible to grant them the status of honorary primates. Invoking Leo Marx's famous dictum, no shepherd, no pastoral, or citing Paul Alpers' very sensible reminder that the central fiction of pastoral, in Kenneth Burke's terminology, its representative anecdote, is not the Golden Age or idyllic landscapes, but herdsmen and their lives, won't get you off. Whatever its origins, and whatever its minimal units, pastoral metaphor spins off images of worlds that are taken from nature. The metaphor affects too durable a transport. We are, after or before all, according to Heidegger, shepherds of being. For Raymond Williams, pastoral and its kitschy, downgraded equivalents from the 16th century onwards are understood as a sort of perpetual stasis machine that sustains a murderous environmental and social fiction. An escalator, Williams famously calls it, moving without pause, forever backwards, into a receding image of the Golden Age du jour. Rhetorically, it may seem that I should, or am about to disagree with Williams and Company's version of pastoral, but it's not quite that simple. One thing I have learned is that tactically, it's best to agree with everything everyone has ever said about pastoral. This is not because I'm some happy shepherd advocating a pastoral pluralism, but rather because everyone in his or her own way has his or her own particular section of the rhizome correct. The extended or general text of pastoral as archive, will manifest in different times and places, folded in strange and seemingly contradictory ways. Williams flags this point explicitly very early on in The Country and the City. The initial problem, he writes, is one of perspective. Where you find yourself distributed, that is, in relation to pastoral. As you may remember, he begins the book with a cannily lyrical reconstruction of the two networks he has inhabited, or fallen between, which is more correct, familial and academic, which pars out loosely into country and city, but which already, by his description, by the transport technologies that interpenetrate, fail to sit happily in either category. His rendering of the history of pastoral is the gradual localizing of the dream, and then into a description and then some idealization of actual English country life and its social and economic relations, takes aim at the process whereby the charity of consumption, a feast, occludes and defers the possibility of a community which may have existed but which remains still to come, a charity of production, of loving relations between men and women who work. The issue here is not.